This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
You're listening to KCBS In Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In Depth.
President Biden stepping away from the presidential race and Vice President Kamala Harris now being the Democrats' choice, which has given the Democratic Party a much needed shot of energy. What does this mean for former President Trump's campaign going forward? And are both parties struggling to appeal to one of the biggest voting demographics in California as well as in the country? Welcome to KCBS In Depth, broadcasting throughout the Bay Area and streaming on the Odyssey app. I'm Mary Hughes. We're covering a lot of ground on this In-Depth, and to help with this, I'm joined by Mike Madrid, Republican political consultant, co-founder of the Lincoln Project, and author of The Latino Century: How America's Largest Minority is Transforming Democracy. Mike Madrid, thank you so much for joining me in this conversation on In Depth.
I'm really looking forward to it.
So, you know, I feel like the landscape keeps changing. It feels like every week. But right now, as we are speaking, former President Donald Trump and his campaign, their focus is really having to shift because they thought they were taking on President Joe Biden. Now, that's all different. President Biden has stepped down. Vice President Kamala Harris is now the candidate. And where do things stand for Trump and his campaign right now?
So that's a great question. And I think the way that we like to approach these issues and that question as campaign professionals is to understand that there's oftentimes a difference between the fundamentals of a race and the trajectory of the race, as well as how voter opinion is responding to these very historic developments. So for the moment, the overall trajectory, the fundamentals, as we call them, of the race have not changed. They didn't change with this disastrous debate that Joe Biden had, an assassination attempt on the former president, or the changing of a nominee, a convention. All of these developments over the past month have really not moved the overall race by about more than 2.5 points in either direction. For the moment, what we're seeing, though, is a rather euphoric response on behalf of Democrats who finally, after probably one of the worst three-week negative news cycles in modern presidential history, feel not only relief, but again, the possibility of getting back into a competitive position in this race. And that despondence is gone. The exuberance is clear. And you're going to see, I think, Kamala Harris and whoever her VP pick will be get a bump, certainly a honeymoon of some sort. But you can fully expect the race to narrow back into its normal range in about 7 to 10 days. And I expect that this is going to be a very, very close race come November, despite the fact that we still have another 3 months or so of what will undoubtedly be even more historical developments.
Speaking on who we're looking at on the Republican side of things with the choice of J.D. Vance as Trump's running mate. How does that seem to be working out, not just for Trump and his image out there in the world, but how is the Republican voter base responding to him as the selection for vice president?
Well, let me say that I've always believed since the moment he was announced that it was a peculiar choice. And the reason might be a little bit different than others are suspecting. And the reason is because J.D. Vance actually considerably underperformed baseline Republican support in Ohio, which is now a decidedly red state. What that means is he's really not the best person to even congeal or convene the disparate sides of the Republican coalition. He really is truly a MAGA candidate. And that was a sign that this was going to be the strategy of a Republican team that was perhaps overconfident, too confident in the position that they were in, or felt that they had a significant weakness in getting their base to show up and vote. So I think what you're seeing is some level of buyer's remorse at this point in time. A lot of it, again, I think is probably unfairly focused on candidate style. I'm not a very big believer that candidate style changes the underlying data points for a candidate, but his lack of appeal beyond that two-thirds of the Republican base is what is particularly problematic. I'm not even convinced that he's the best candidate to bring back or pick a state out of what's been termed the blue wall of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I'm just not, the jury's really still out for me. And this was a voter base. Remember, the Republican base has been voting for a candidate other than Donald Trump. 20% of Republicans consistently throughout the primary this year have been choosing another candidate even months after those other candidates dropped out of the race. That's an extraordinary sign of weakness. And J.D. Vance's pick does not bolster that. It does not fix that problem. In fact, it doubles down on that problem. So I think that some of the remorse that you're seeing is from some of those tepid Republicans, those 20% of Republicans who were uneasy with Trump in the first place, were probably looking for somebody to reassure them. And J.D. Vance doesn't fit that bill, at least not at this moment in time.
Would there have been a better choice out of former opposing candidates for Trump that he could have pulled from, and anyone that he was up against that he could have been like, hey, why don't you hop onto this ticket and help strengthen going forward?
Well, I mean, certainly Tim Scott could have helped even marginally with African-American voters, and marginal, differences with the black vote would have tectonic differences in the outcome of the race. Marco Rubio didn't run against him in this primary. He did, of course, in 2016. Marco Rubio would have been a fantastic choice. And the reason why is because they're expansive. They literally do add a couple points to places where Democrats are already really struggling with, either black voters or Latino voters. A woman would have been a good choice, certainly not Nikki Haley. I think Nikki Haley was not only not considered, but I think she would actually not help the ticket. But another woman candidate would have been a good choice. And the fact that Trump chose not to go with an expansive vision of where the party was going and not only regressed to Republican base, but a small share of the Republican base, I think is very telling. And we need to kind of look at that as a data point on not just who they think they are as a political party, but what they think electorally is the likeliest strategy for them to get to 270 electoral votes.
With Kamala Harris now being the opposition for the GOP, do you see going up against her as something that's going to continue to unify the Republican voter base and the GOP in general? Or is this going to be a harder battle?
Yeah, so it's important, again, to put this in race in context, and it is a little bit unique in that we are witnessing the most historically highly negatively partisanized electorate in probably American history. And by that, what I mean is both sides, Republicans and Democrats, are voting as much or more intensely against the other side than they are for their own candidates. That allows voters on both sides to overlook deep flaws in their candidates and deep weaknesses in their candidates. We saw that with Joe Biden, where 83% of people were saying he's too weak, he's too old to be the president, but am I voting for him? And he was getting 90% plus of Democratic voters who were still going to vote for him. And I bring that up because it really does answer, I think, the question most succinctly, and that is this race is going to be very close because both party bases, regardless of the characteristics, the dynamics, the flaws, the personalities of their respective candidates, are far more concerned by the other side winning. So there's not like a wide swath of women who will now change their vote, or African Americans being re-energized, or you know, the Republican base having some deep concerns about J.D. Vance. They're really much more concerned about making sure that their team wins, that their tribe wins. And again, this is pervasive on both sides of the aisle. Even through all of these historical changes, and they were quite dramatic over the past month, we're not seeing movement in the polling that is of great consequence. And again, even being 3 months out, most of that, those differences in those swings will settle into a very predictable range. So we've got to be careful in predicting too much about what each candidate brings or doesn't bring, because there's not a whole lot of evidence and data to justify some of the emotional roller coaster that we've all been on as a country and will likely continue to be. Now, margins, as I said earlier, do make a difference. And if Kamala Harris can bring back this leakage that she's had with African-American voters, the Democrats have been experiencing for a couple election cycles, if they're able to mitigate or even reverse some of the slide with Hispanic voters, you could see Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, perhaps even North Carolina become much more promising for the Democratic base, or at least believe that they can strategically position and invest resources into those states in a way that they were not otherwise doing. So the map, is changing, but it's important to keep in perspective what that change means. We're literally talking 100,000, maybe 120,000 voters across these six states that are being appealed to. And so we've got to be very careful about, overimposing too many of these dynamics and suggesting that they're perhaps having these broad implications in what they mean for the electorate or not.
Of course, a thread through all of this is what the voters will see and what will appeal to them. Now we know what we're looking at least to a great degree, with former President Donald Trump and, you know, currently Vice President Kamala Harris, and now the Democrat nominee. This could change how voters are looking at issues, especially for demographics that have a lot of voting power. And this is something that you have spoken and written on quite extensively, and that is the Latino vote. And for both of these candidates, what do they need to do in order to secure that vote for them? And more broadly speaking, has enough been done to address the issues that Latino voters are serious about?
Well, it's a great question. And let me answer that first by addressing the latter and saying declaratively, no, neither party has done anywhere near what they need to do to win the hearts and minds of the fastest growing segment of the electorate, Latino voters. Broadly, the party that is able to capture the votes of this rapidly emerging multi-ethnic working class voter will be the dominant party of the next generation in American politics. And for the moment, the Democratic Party has really struggled with the working class piece, which sounds counterintuitive to most Democrats who believe very firmly that they are still the party of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the working class. But working class voters have been leaving the Democratic Party for the better part of a decade now. And the reason is largely a function of this education divide, where those with a college degree, animated largely by cultural issues, gun control, Dobbs, abortion issues, marriage equality, have been moving decisively towards the Democratic Party. But on the other end, the working class, which is increasingly non-white, by the way, black and brown voters are shifting to the right because of these economic populist issues that are being most articulated in the Republican Party at this point in time. more protectionist, more isolationist, supporting tariffs, but opposing taxes on tips, for example. The Republican Party seems to be better positioned to protect the interests of the economic and pocketbook concerns that a lot of these non-white voters are increasingly compelled by. In many ways, what we're witnessing is the transformation of our whole notion of what a quote-unquote minority voter is, compelled less by racial and ethnic cues and more by economic and class considerations as the country grows more diverse. And so the Republican Party, oftentimes despite itself, not because of what it's trying to do to reach out to these voters, is winning a greater and greater share. And this class divide, which is a function of the education divide, is now becoming a racial divide. And the Republican Party is becoming more diverse while the Democratic Party is becoming less racially and ethnically diverse.
In Depth will return after a moment.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age. Wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, M-I-D-I.
We're talking, you know, we've been talking a lot here about nationally, but everything kind of has a ripple effect. How have you seen that divide and the sort of paradox of the Republican Party being able to get more of a foothold with working class voters, which are becoming more and more non-white, and Democrats maybe having a harder time getting that foothold here in California? Because, you know, this is a state that we tend to think of as incredibly liberal and progressive. How has that been playing out here?
So that's a really great question, because and it's really kind of central to the thesis of my book, which, you know, as somebody who came back to California in the mid-1990s after studying on the East Coast, I wanted to watch this demographic change unfold and be a practitioner in it, write research about it, and again, be part of it in real terms. California, during one of the or in the midst of the largest ethnic demographic transformation in our nation's history, was not only not a precursor of things to come, it was a lagging indicator. The rightward shift began and started to materialize of Latino voters everywhere else but in California. Having said that, it is now very apparent from voter registration and electoral outcomes since 2020, and increasingly in 2022, that it is now part of what is happening in California. Latinos have the weakest partisan anchor of any voter group in California. They are increasingly registering with the Republican Party, and they are increasingly voting Republican. And it's not geographically isolated. It is pervasive in literally every single state assembly, state senate, and congressional district in the entire state. So why was California a lagging indicator? There's two reasons. The first is the Latino voter in California is much more likely to be a naturalized citizen, a migrant, a first generation American, or their children who are second generation. In most other places, what we're witnessing is an explosion of third and now a discernible fourth generation voter, which is much more politically assimilated and far less responsive to the racial and ethnic lens through which the Democratic Party communicates to these voters. So now, as California is starting to see third and fourth generation Latinos catch up to their recently naturalized voter, we're starting to see a balancing out in the partisanship, even in deepest blue California. But there's another reason, and perhaps equally as important: the dramatic unaffordability of housing has slowed the upward mobility of Latino voters. And the Democratic Party, as it stands nationally, but also in California, is a party comprised largely of wealthy, white, college-educated homeowners and poor, non-college-educated renters who are Latino. And that coalition, the glue that has worked for 25 years, has been anti-Republicanism, both of them not liking the Republican Party for 25 years. The problem is, as that demographic, that Latino demographic, becomes more assimilated, that anti-Republicanism isn't working anymore. And the glue in that coalition is beginning to weaken, and the coalition is starting to unravel. Now, it's slowly, it's only happening a couple percentage points at a time, but it's discernible, it's measurable, and you're seeing it in competitive congressional districts. So the changing Latino voter is breaking more Republican, but where it's not more Republican, it is more weakly associated with the Democratic Party. That may sound like the same thing, but it's not. Both dynamics are showing a trend away from Democratic performance, again, from the fastest growing segment of the electorate.
What can Democrats do then to shore that up and to let Latino voters or just any other, you know, voter base that they need to be reaching both in the state and to nationally as well to reach those voters and say, you know, we're here for you?
Well, the solution is actually very simple, but politically it's extraordinarily complicated for the Democratic Party because of who it's becoming. The answer is they need to have a very aggressive working class aspirational agenda, starting with housing. 1 in 5 Hispanic men are employed in the residential construction space or a related field. So at a time when interest rates have tripled over the last 5 years and the value of our currency is devalued by 20%, it's quantifiably true that these voters were doing better economically in the last administration. And they remember that, and they're voting like that. But more importantly, you have to understand that as Latinos become the fastest growing segment of the blue collar workforce, that means they are increasingly employed in the energy space, the construction spaces I just mentioned, manufacturing jobs, agriculture, mining, forestry, all of which are industries that view the Democratic Party as an existential threat to their livelihood. So Latinos are voting just like their white, rural, non-college educated counterparts, because that's essentially who they are and who they're becoming. And so the Democratic Party can easily fix this by becoming more supportive of those industries. But the problem is, as it's consolidated white, wealthier, college-educated voters, those industries are anathema to that voter base who really prioritize eliminating or transforming the economy away from those industries. And so it's got a political problem. There's a political difficulty there.
So, you know, at the beginning of our conversation here, you know, it was touched on that we can't look too far ahead, that it's probably going to, you know, right now there's been an injection of hope on the Democrat side of things with Kamala Harris now in the race, but that everything will kind of level out and this will probably be a closer race than people might be anticipating right this moment. What's the numbers and the data telling you right now about what we might see in November?
Well, let me say, for those that are supporting Kamala Harris and the Democratic ticket, this is a very winnable race. And I've always believed that the fundamentals of this race have benefited a Democratic incumbent for the better part of the past couple of years. Having said that, there are some structural challenges when you're facing a candidate, especially a Republican candidate like Donald Trump. So what's going to have to happen in order to have a Kamala Harris win is she's going to have to not only stem the leakage of Black and brown voters, she's going to have to dial that back and start winning a more historical Democratic share of those voters. She's also going to have to get a bigger break amongst women, which seems more likely than not in the post-Dobbs era. Keep in mind The one thing, or the three things that have really peeled Republicans off, right? We've always been going, how can all these Republicans still support Donald Trump? Those 20% of Republican voters that were ditching him in the primary, literally getting up off of the couch, going down to the high school gym to vote for a candidate that dropped out 2 months ago against Donald Trump, is a very significant sign that there are a lot of Republicans that want something else. And the vast majority of those mentioned three things. One, the January 6th insurrection. That was a breaking point for many. Two, the big lie, the lie about stealing elections in the first place after the November elections of 2020. And three, the Dobbs decision. Very impactful for women, obviously, specifically, but a lot of folks generally. All three of those things happened past the 2020 election. None of that was baked in. This is all new information and a new dynamic where Republicans could be in a much weaker support position for Donald Trump than the polls are showing. And again, while Donald Trump has shown very strong support in the polling amongst in the Republican base, he underperformed with Republicans in about 47 of the 50 primaries that were held earlier this year. So there's a lot of reason to believe that Donald Trump is weaker than he is showing in the polling. But again, anybody who is suggesting that this will be anything other than a very, very close race has probably not been watching American politics for the past 25 years.
And one last question for you, Mike. But if Trump doesn't win in November, what does this mean for the GOP? What is their outcome after this if that doesn't go in the direction that they're hoping for?
So I was asked this question quite a bit in 2020, to which I said there's probably not going to be a very significant change because Trump is not done. That's a different consideration. If Trump loses in 2024, this November, I believe the Republican Party essentially atomizes. It's not going to split into a right-left, bend, and you're not going to see the emergence of a Ron DeSantis or an Ivanka Trump, for example, to come and replace this leader. And the reason why that's the case is because the Republican Party is now the one fundamental issue you cannot be against, in the same way taxes, supporting tax increases was the necessary component of being a Republican for most of my career. Today, you have to demonstrate fealty to Donald Trump. That will change. If Donald Trump loses, that will change. And there's no ideological foxholes for people to go into because they sacrificed all of their policy positions and the basic tenets of conservatism to get into that foxhole and support Donald Trump. So without him as a leader, without him as a figurehead, I don't know where this goes other than to say it probably shatters into many different pieces. Donald Trump will still be a factor. He will still be a very dominant figure in GOP politics for the rest of his lifetime. There's no question about it. In fact, his children will probably be dominant figures in the Republican Party. But the likelihood of the GOP being a more regional party is greater than it is reconstituting or unifying the different bands of the GOP, because those 20% of voters that we're talking about are ideologically and policy driven. And without Donald Trump unifying the party, that right-left split doesn't just break into two. It moves into numerous different directions. And I think the likelihood of a multi-party structure becomes much more real.
Mike Madrid, I want to thank you so much for being a part of this conversation and giving me your perspective here. It was great. Thank you.
It's always great to be with you. And thank you for making the time for the conversation.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. Just go to the podcast tab and look for In Depth. You can also hear In Depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Download the app on your smartphone and favorite KCBS radio. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.